The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 375, Black and Mormon, How Are Things on the Ground After the 1978 Priesthood Ban, a panel featuring Darren Smith, Alma Allred, Ken Driggs, and Keith Hamilton.
Respective communities and spread the word, so to speak. My name is Darren Smith, and I'm also one of the contributors. I don't know if I'm going to say a whole lot about my project as much as I'm going to allow these three men to talk about theirs. There are eight contributors to the volume. We have two of the four or five that should be here. As you know, my mentor, friend, and collaborator, Newell Bringhurst, was also responsible in putting this project together. He cannot be here, and he's very, very upset because there were some scheduling issues, I guess, some overlapping of time. So Newell does send his regards, and I'm sure at some point in time we'll hear from him about his contributions as well. To my right, we have Alma Allred. Alma currently is the Director of Parking Services at the University of Utah. He has a very big job during the expansion and during the Olympics. He was turning red often. I've known Alma since I came down to Utah. I left Ricks College and then transferred to the University of Utah, and Alma and I had a very, very interesting conversation in his office. I think the context was parking tickets that I had accumulated, but Alma engaged me in a very, very unorthodox conversation about blacks in the priesthood, and ever since then we've been friends. We've remained friends. Ever since then, and when this volume was in the workings, I asked Alma if he would write a piece for it, because Alma had some fascinating ideas about this, and I'm sure you'll all find it interesting and exciting. I think that what he's done is actually use a scriptural analysis to sort of demystify this notion of blacks as cursed, In fact, I've been hounding him about it, and I'm glad he finally finished it, and so it'll be in print, and looking forward to seeing that. To my far left is Ken Driggs. Most of you probably know Ken. Ken is no stranger to Sunstone. He has written a lot, and Ken was also asked to write a piece about his experiences in Atlanta. Ken has been a champion for furthering the cause of increasing the number of representation in the Atlanta area in particular, but also in his ward. And his insights into the Atlanta experience might provide us with a broader template of how to proselytize amongst African Americans, more importantly, more specifically, how to retain them. And I think the Atlanta ward is doing some great things, and so Ken will talk about that experience in his piece. To my right, is Keith Hamilton. Keith is an attorney that's practicing law in this community. Keith is not one of the contributors, although I hounded him about it, but he never did respond back to a brother, but it's all good. Keith is in the process of writing his own piece entitled The 11th Hour Laborers, and I'm sure it's due out soon. And Keith has a lot of interesting ideas about this as well. And what you'll notice and what you'll gather from the discussion today from the panelists, particularly with Keith, in respect to Keith and I, is that just because we black doesn't mean we agree with each other. And the typical assumption is that black folks are monolithic, and we're not. We do disagree. We do have our own opinions about this issue. Nevertheless, what Keith has to offer certainly furthers the discussion towards this issue of blacks in the priesthood and the legacy that it leaves behind for us to deal with it, basically those of us who are saints, who are practicing Latter-day Saints. Nevertheless, I'm going to stop gabbing, and I'm going to allow, we'll start with Ken, and we'll move from Ken to Alma to Keith. After they have responded, we'll have some time for question and answer, and we'll proceed up to that point.
What I have passed around, I've discovered digital photography recently, and it's obviously gone to my head. And I've started just taking snapshots of my ward, and I've put a big notebook in the lobby of the ward that have those 8x10s. And those are just pictures of people in my ward, and you'll get some sense of, you know, what it's like. It's typical in some ways and not typical in others. The Atlanta ward is part of the Atlanta stake. It is an inner-city ward with very wide boundaries that is right near Fort McPherson, the largest military base in the Atlanta area. It was created in 1995 by consolidating several branches that were principally, or not heavily African-American, and then a big slice off of a couple of other ward boundaries. And the ward now, I guess our membership is right at half African-American and half Anglo or thereabouts in a large smattering of other. I get up in sacrament meetings. I used to make my bishop nervous. I'd get up and count sort of my own little racial breakdown, and he used to just be uncomfortable when I did that. Now they ask me what it is because the clerk sometimes forgets to do it. And we run anywhere from 40 to 60% black in sacrament meetings pretty regularly. Our turnout is anywhere from 110 to 160 bodies in sacrament meeting. That's not counting the junior Sundays or little kids that are off in the room somewhere else. Anyway, just kind of so you know, the first two bishops of the ward were African American, and the two we've had since are African American or white. The second bishop is now first counselor in the stake presidency. He's a man named Tony Parker. It's likely to me that he is going to be the next stake president. We even have some like third generation African American Mormons in the ward. We have several who have served missions. A sacrament meeting not too long ago, they had four sacrament meeting speakers who were all young men who had just gotten mission calls, including Tony's son, who was a student out at BYU. Our Stake Relief Society president is African American. The Stake High Council is probably about a quarter black. Let me tell you a few personal stories. I think my contribution really is more personal stories about a unit like this. There was an article a couple of years ago in the New Yorker about Mormons, some of you may remember. And the reporter who was writing that, the writer, somehow found his way to me. And it turned out that he had a relative in a nursing home in Atlanta, and he came to visit. And we sat and had a long dinner talking about a variety of Mormon topics. And it happened to be a day when a black couple in my ward had gotten married in the temple. And they were having a reception in the ward meeting hall that all the members had sort of pitched together and had done this temple. And I told this guy, you know, you got to come down here and see this. And it's part of my normal campaign to get people, reporters, to stop coming to Utah and talking to some people in Utah and thinking they know everything they need to know about Mormonism. I mean, you know, that's like going to Rome and thinking knowing everything about Catholics. And so he came and spent about 3 hours at this reception. And I was kind of cruising around eavesdropping on the conversations. And lo and behold, one of the first people he talked to brought up blacks in the priesthood, and two or three other people brought it up. Now, that's a subject that I had been afraid to bring up in talking with members in my ward. I was a little afraid to give them information that they may not have previously known about that was going to cause them testimony problems. And what I quickly learned from eavesdropping in these conversations was that all the people who decided to stay knew about it. And they had stuck. They had come to various resolutions of it, but they knew about that history. And I was free to talk to, we were free to talk about this. This wasn't a taboo subject that was going to cause people problems. So I started having conversations with people in the hall, and one thing led to another, and I just learned a lot more about sort of their, how they came to their testimonies. And then I guess about a year ago, the Salt Lake Tribune ran their big section on the anniversary of the Priesthood for All revelation. And they flew a team, a reporter and photographer, out. And I set up a bunch of interviews for them, was able to eavesdrop on a lot of those interviews. And it ended up being, one day in particular, just the most incredible testimony meeting. I came away just feeling so strongly about these brothers and sisters that I now knew a lot better having heard their stories. And again, the old blacks in the priesthood issue came up, and all these people explained how they had resolved it and how committed they were to the church. And it made me realize that we have in Atlanta at least a core group that is temple attending, frequently gone on missions, office holding, very committed people. And in talking openly with them, they pretty consistently say they felt like the church wasn't doing a real good job in sort of dealing with racial kinds of issues. And these were people who were not speaking in a hostile context. These were believers who were committed, but they just wanted something more. A lot of times I would hear things like how good it would be at conference to just look at the conference broadcast and see some color on the podium. They would see a black face speaking. And frankly, I've been thinking about the two vacancies in the quorum right now, thinking, boy, now would be the time to make a statement. I'm not saying that I expect that, but at this point in time, but I think the church could make a pretty bold move in that sense. And in a very small sense, we've started seeing literature in the ward with black couples on it. This is literature that's clearly directed towards African-American investigators. For the last year, I can't remember that we've had a baptism of a white convert. I think everybody we've had in the last year has been African-American. My sense is, I've heard Darren talk about this a little earlier, and I think he was talking about essentially middle-class, striving blacks or the people who are attracted to the church. That is absolutely what I think I see in our ward. We see more women converts than men. They are frequently single parents. It is a poor part of the city, and I know the church assists a number of families there, but it is more women than men. For the last 3 years, I've taught the Gospel Principles class in my ward, and we get a lot of good discussions in there, and it's also, it's another way that's helped me get to know our members. And my sense is that people are joining the church, and I don't think this is peculiar to African Americans. I think this is everybody. I think people join the church because they are looking for structure in their lives and help in their day-to-day mortal lives. I don't think people become Mormons because they're suddenly attracted to our doctrines or some esoteric belief. I think they're looking for help with their kids and their families. They're looking for ways to help them raise their children in good ways, better ways to feel good about themselves. And I think we offer a message that is particularly attractive to people on that level. And another thing we've done in that ward, some of y'all may have heard of Samuel and Amanda Chambers. Samuel Chambers was a slave who converted to the church in the 1840s. When he was emancipated, he worked as a laborer, I guess, in the South for some period of time and walked to Utah in 1870 with his wife and some of her relatives. Became apparently a pretty prosperous and prosperous citizen and successful businessman. He didn't read or write, but he gave testimonies, and in one ward there was a clerk who took pretty detailed notes of those, and they included a lot of biographical material on his life. He's a very interesting man. And the church has in its archives one particularly stunning, striking portrait of he and his wife later on in their life. It doesn't look like somebody would ever be anybody's slave. He's a very substantial, solid-looking kind of guy. So we had a large blow-up of that print done in a nice frame and hung it in the lobby of the ward with a little metal plaque underneath it that gives their names, birth and death dates, and then the identification as Utah pioneers, Utah Mormon pioneers. And I notice in the ward pretty regularly people, African-American members who have taken an investigator kind of under their wing will frequently bring them to that portrait and introduce and, you know, tell them that story. And I think that way of helping people sort of identify, find a place in the history helps. I think we should be, personally think we should be doing more of that. I think in the ward, when I first came there, Tony Parker was bishop, this man who is now in first counselor in the state presidency. And Tony really set an open and inviting climate. He hugged everybody. He sent them notes. He knew what was going on in everybody's life. I don't know that I've ever had a bishop so involved in everybody's life and having such an intimate knowledge of them as Tony. And one of the things that happens there is when you stand up to speak, you say good morning or introduce yourself, and the congregation comes back with good morning. It's a kind of a part of an African-American religious vestige. Tony encouraged that and a number of other things and just set a tone that I think makes members sort of impervious to religious, not impervious to, but less susceptible to religious slights. We get visitors in there who are not familiar with a lot of black Mormons. We're the ward that if you go to a big conference in downtown Atlanta and you're looking for the address of the nearest church, you're going to get us. And it's right on the MARTA line, the mass transit line. So we get an awful lot of out-of-staters and a lot of Utah Mormons and a lot of missionaries who clearly have never been around this many black people in their lives and sometimes are a little inappropriate. But the members always just hug them, you know. Nothing is ever said. Nobody is looking to be slighted. I just get the sense that people in that ward really work at getting along and making something of this. And I think people take pride in the fact that it is a very mixed ward that seems to be successful and have something invested in that part of it succeeding. And I don't know how to put a finger on that other than it was my sense that Tony Parker, this bishop, really made that a priority and made it set a tone in the ward that I don't think anybody else has been free to sort of mess with who may have succeeded him. I think other bishops might have set other tones, but this is still Tony's ward. I don't know that I have anything more to add. Most of what I wanted to share with you was just some experience with this ward. I would recommend that if you're ever in Atlanta, you should come by and visit this ward. As I said, our stake is about a quarter to a third black. There are other black bishops in the ward. I visited many of those. I think ours is probably the most distinct in sort of its flavor. But it is just a wonderful ward. I don't know that I've ever had one I felt better about being a part of as a member of the church. And I think there's some things that we need to export from that unit to hopefully others. Thank you.
It's nice to be here. I have enjoyed my relationship with Darren for many years. We became closer and closer each time that we threatened to tow him away. And I have to preface this by saying that I'm not a sociologist. I'm, like you said, I'm the director of parking at the University of Utah. I have taught church history at the Institute of Religion for about 8 years now. My primary interest in the blacks and the priesthood came about as a result of my family. We are a rare part of our family in that we're monogamous, my father and my brothers and sister, whereas the rest of the group are not. And I was very familiar with my grandfather's journals, who was a missionary in 1896. And he would, I don't know if it was common at that time, but he would often put prayers in his journal while he was a missionary. And he would ask that the Lord would please open up the way for the blacks to receive the priesthood. Because he was a missionary traveling in the Oklahoma Territory without purse or scrip. And they would come into a little community, and the only people that would feed them or give them a place to stay were blacks. He said, the whites treat us with absolute disdain. He couldn't understand why blacks couldn't have the priesthood. And he would consistently write about this in his journal. When I was so surprised that the next generation of fundamentalists, his children, he was a leader of the early fundamentalists, were livid when the church announced the revelation extending priesthood to all. And I just thought, what happened here? How could this have happened? And at the time, I had an office across the street from the church office building. I spent the next several months, my lunch break each day, over pouring through the archives and looking at the scriptures and seeing what I could find to see if they had any justification for being so adamant that the priesthood was reserved only for whites. And I found some interesting things. And at the time, I just wrote down what I had found and thought, you know, I don't know if anybody's going to be interested in this. And I think the first person I asked to read it was Darren. He was in my office, and we finally agreed not to tow his car away. And we became friends for a few minutes, and he mentioned that he was LDS. And I said, I've been looking for some perspective on something I put together, and I'd like you to read this. He read it. He liked it. And he encouraged me to see if I could get it published. I put it off until he hounded me and put it in his book, a significantly revised framework. However, over the next couple of years, I have lots of cousins, and that's putting it mildly. I think my Uncle Ruin had 62 children, and my dad was one of 21 children, so I have lots of cousins, and occasionally they will contact me. And these are fundamentalists who were raised as fundamentalists, and the one problem that they have in joining the church is not polygamy, it's not the Adam God theory, it's not a host of other things, it is blacks in the priesthood. And very often they would ask me how I felt about it, and I would give them a copy of what I gave to Darren. And I think about 35 or 40 of my close cousins have joined the church as a result of that. And I know that my Uncle Owen authorized the publication of a 100-page pamphlet complaining about this pamphlet, this article that I wrote. And they say something interesting that I was kind of pleased with, that they say Alma has been able to demonstrate quite a few scriptures that show that there should not be a ban for the blacks having the priesthood. But we know that that there were secret things that were passed on only by word of mouth, and so if you follow the scriptures, you'll follow Alma Allred right back into the church. And I felt kind of good about that, because as I look at the scriptures and I look at the history of Israel, I see the reasons that were given for decades on why the blacks could not have the priesthood are wholly inconsistent. They just don't add up to what is rational, reasonable, logical, or historical. And one of the things that I'd like to just mention a couple of those, because and I'm sure most of you, since you're here, you have some kind of an interest, and you've probably read some of the literature on this subject. But one of the astounding, for me, comments that Sterling McMurrin came up with, he got it from David O. McKay in a letter. Actually, David O. McKay had a son named Llewellyn McKay, and Llewellyn McKay was also concerned about this issue, and he wrote to his father and said, "What is the doctrinal basis for the blacks not having the priesthood?" And David O. McKay wrote back this comment, and I know that some people have complained that this isn't a legitimate quote. They've said, "No, you know, that's Sterling McMurrin has kind of remembered it incorrectly." And when I heard that, I went to David O. McKay's son, Robert McKay, and I said, "Are you aware of this quote?" And he said, "I am, and it's valid." So I think it's still pretty legitimate. He says, "There is not now," and this is back in 1967, "and there never has been a doctrine in this church that the Negroes are under a divine curse. We believe that we have scriptural precedent for withholding the priesthood from the Negro. It is a practice, not a doctrine, and the practice will someday be changed, and that's all there is to it." In the LDS Church, we have doctrine, and we have practice, and we have a lot of folklore. And I think for many generations, well, three or four generations at least, people were trying to assign a reason for the prohibition against the blacks. And they didn't use any scriptural arguments. They used mythology. They used folklore. And there were church leaders, Joseph Fielding Smith, Bruce R. McConkie. They said some pretty specific, dogmatic things, as well as Brigham Young. But none of these things really reached to the scriptures, basically. And got a good thought and it just fled. But I have to fast forward a little bit. Several years ago, I was talking to several of the faculty members of the University of Utah Institute of Religion, because one of the teachers had said something about, well, I don't know how many of you grew up in the church or were confronted with the idea that blacks were less valiant in the premortal existence. Brigham Young answered that question on Christmas Day when he was asked by his brother, and he said, "There were no neutrals in the War of Heaven. Well, based on the fact that there were no neutrals, then people said, well, maybe they weren't neutral, but maybe they just weren't valiant enough. And I remember growing up hearing that as the rationalization for blacks not having the priesthood. But it comes from nowhere that is scriptural. As I look at the scriptures, the Old Testament, you see that there was not a prohibition against race mingling. Not only that, the prohibition identifies itself with descendants of Canaan. Canaan is not black. His descendants were not black. Go to any biblical encyclopedia, Canaanites were the inhabitants of the Holy Land. They were the Perizzites, the Girgashites, and there was free intermarriage between the Israelites and the Canaanites. Several of these Canaanites, not only in the Law of Moses, the Law of Moses said that the children of Canaanite marriages could enter into the house of the Lord in their third generation. It said the children of Ammonites couldn't enter for 10 generations. Which means there was a stronger prohibition against whites, who were the Ammonites, entering into the house of the Lord and becoming part of the congregation of the Lord, than there was for Canaanites, who, I still say, were not black, they were whites. But the mythology that was built up around this, the folklore, tries to get us to believe that the Canaanites were black, and they weren't. Not only that, you have instances where Canaanite children clearly hold the priesthood when you look at LDS doctrine. Joseph Smith stated, in speaking of plural marriage, that David received his wives from Nathan the prophet, who held the keys of the priesthood in his day. Nathan the prophet's grandfather was an Egyptian, and the book of Abraham tells us that all of the Egyptians were Canaanites. And, as I said, the book of the Law of Moses specifically allows for children of Canaanites to enter into the house of Israel. And when you look at it, there are so many instances of non-Israelite progenitors in such important lines as the priesthood line and the messianic line that it's impossible to hold the idea that there was a prohibition against intermingling with Canaanites. Not only that, historically, throughout Europe, there has never really been any reproach against intermarriage. I mean, you read the play of Othello. Othello is a black Moor who marries Desdemona. Nobody seems to be concerned about that. The Portuguese, who brought slaves from Africa, freely intermarried with them and married throughout Europe. Now, it's interesting. I hate to bring this up too much, but it is what got me most interested in this. The fundamentalist group, the Apostolic Brethren, several years ago, when the blacks were given the priesthood, they determined that that was the straw that broke the camel's back. The church no longer had any authority or any priesthood, so they therefore had to do their own temple work. They started doing their own temple work, started doing their own genealogy, and about a year and a half ago, as a result of this genealogy, one of the major polygamous families that had intermarried throughout the United Apostolic Brethren found that they had African lineage. And this has created a real problem, because they have not only been teaching that blacks can never have the priesthood, but they said if you're ever married to someone with black blood, you lose the priesthood, as does all of your progeny. And so I think we may see a softening on the side of the Apostolic Brethren on whether or not blacks can have the priesthood, because in reality there's no way that there is any pure lineage. I mean, that just, it's bunk. Now, I'm concerned, one of the things in the, what do we call that? It's not a syllabus. Well, in the program, in the directory there, it says, where are we today? I find false doctrine being taught consistently about blacks in the priesthood. Even though the dogmatic assertions by Joseph or by Bruce R. McConkie were taken out of Mormon doctrine, there are still people who are still teaching it, even in the institutes. Interestingly, I can teach my perception of it without any difficulty, and I have confronted some of the other professors, and I've said, "What you're saying is not only false, but it's terribly false. It's inconsistent with so many principles of the gospel to think that." And they're still saying, less valiant, seed of Cain, all these kinds of things that just simply aren't... aren't able to be validated from the scriptures. And as we have confrontations, I'll say, can you show me that? And they say, well, I know that you disagree with that, and we're going to have to stay with our disagreements. And I think that there's a great deal of territory that needs to be covered before the white folk in the church give up these long-cherished perceptions that have no more basis than the story of David W. Patton encountering Cain on his trip in Tennessee. They just don't have any basis, in fact. And a lot of this is outlined in the article that will be upcoming in October, and I encourage you to check it out. And thank you for your time.
I'm grateful to be here. I want to, I guess, preface my remarks by giving an example of something that happened to me when I was a young bishop. Well, when I was bishop in San Francisco, and I can appreciate what Brother Driggs had to say, because at the time, it was 1989, I was not long after off my mission. I'd only been a member of the church less than 10 years. Just recently left BYU as a law student. I was in the Navy, living on Treasure Island. I was the bishop of the Bay Ward in San Francisco, and came a need for a change in the stake presidency, and so I was interviewed by a regional representative in one of the quorum of the 70. And when I came in, actually I was late because I attended a sealing here in Salt Lake, and I drove back immediately, and I got there, and the general authority said, "Hey, you're the bishop of the Bay Ward," and I said, "Yes, sir," and he looked at me and said, "Tough ward, tough ward," and just smiled. And then we started talking, and he said at the time, this was 1989, he said at the time that perhaps the ward I was bishop over was the most diverse ward in the continental United States, or in the church maybe. We had Hispanics, Latinos, we had Asians, we had Polynesians, we had blacks, we had Caucasians. We just had a whole mix of people, and I took a little righteous, if there's such a thing as righteous pride, according to Edward Taft Benson. But I took some pride in knowing that. The second incident is what didn't happen too much long after that. I had to practice my bishopric, and I had the practice of going down to the doors of the chapel, to the foyer, to position ourselves during the right before the closing prayer to greet people as they left, because like Atlanta, we had my ward was right downtown in San Francisco, and when people looked on the phone book or called, they called my ward building, and we had the early schedule, so we had a lot of visitors. And that particular day, we had a couple parents from here in the Wasatch Front a mother and a father that were visiting their recently married son and his spouse, who was attending dental school at the University of Pacific. And as I came through, the student introduced his parents to me, and then they walked off in the foyer, and the mother didn't realize she was talking as loud as she was, but she said, and I don't remember the student's name, but I'm going to call him David, said, David, why didn't you tell me your bishop was black? And and he just said, we really don't notice it. He's just Bishop Hamilton to us. And I tell you that story because I think that's what, you know, we're striving for. I mean, that made me feel very good that I wasn't the black bishop. I actually think it is demeaning to me to be looked at as a black Latter-day Saint, because I just want to be a Latter-day Saint. And when I was bishop, it was tough enough being bishop, particularly as young as I was, without raising all these racial issues and all that. But that led me to, because when I became a bishop, the issue was raised to me, and so I started to research it so I can try to give an answer. And that research has led to this book that I'm trying to put out. But I guess my position on it is, and my research has shown that I believe that the ban was from God. And I haven't seen anything, and I've read all the different things that other people said. I haven't seen anything that leads me to believe otherwise. I really wish that people would, when they were asked about whether or not, you know, whatever reason, I wish they would just say, we don't know. If people would have said before, why were the blacks restricted from the priesthood? And if they would have just said, we don't know, then this whole history of folklore wouldn't be there. And there wouldn't be the Cain story and the lack of valiance in the priesthood story and all this. Now, I'm a firm believer that the priesthood is of God. And I believe that God can do whatever he wants with his priesthood. He can give it to whoever he wants, including the women, when he wants to. He can give it to people at some time before others. He can do whatever he wants with his priesthood. And you talk about where are the blacks now, where the blacks should be, where anyone else in the church should be, especially the males, and that is, they should be striving to, one, gain the priesthood, and two, use the priesthood to bless the lives of others. You know, and so I have some, and Darren and I have had a discussion on how strongly I feel about discussing this issue when we really don't know the answers. We don't have any answers. You know, the problem with this issue is we don't know where the restrictions started. We don't know who initiated the restriction. We don't know whether it was by revelation or whatever. But we do know when the restriction ended. And we do know how it ended. And I personally do not see much difference between the 1978 revelation, which opened the priesthood to all worthy males, particularly the blacks who were restricted, and the opening of the gospel to the Gentiles in the time of Cornelius. I mean, you know, if you want to, you know, go back to historic, first of all, I don't believe this is a matter of history. This is a matter of faith. And the reason the saints in Atlanta and myself and then you go back in history and you look at Elijah Abel and people like Jane Manning James, who I've been a part of her play, putting her play forth, and I've studied her history. How they stayed active is because they understood as a matter of faith that the church was true, and that they didn't let the priesthood issue, the ban or restriction issue, keep them from accomplishing what they felt were their purposes in life. I'd like to kind of read you a couple things that I think shed some light on this as a matter of faith. Elder Oak said this in this book, The Lord's Way. He said, while study and scholarship has their place pertaining to gospel issues, by themselves they're inadequate toward helping us fully realize our goal of understanding spiritual truth. He said that things of God cannot be learned solely by study and reason. Despite their essential and beneficial uses, the methods of study and reason are insufficient as ways of approaching God and understanding the doctrines of His gospel. He says the things of God must be learned in His own way through faith in God and revelation from the Holy Ghost. Jacob, the brother Nephi, said, "No man knoweth of his ways save it be revealed unto him." Now, back in 1973, Dr. Hugh Nibley wrote an article that was published in Dialogue, and I found this to be very, very interesting. In fact, I almost personally adopted it as my creed concerning this matter. And Dr. Nibley described the church's restrictive practices and I agree, it's a practice. It's not a doctrine. It's a practice. But we have many practices. Okay, the fact that they stopped using wine and we use water is a practice. Okay, when I went on my mission with Professor Kimball's son, I was called to a 24-month mission, and for a while that practice was for missionaries, male missionaries that only serve 18 months. So I came home after 18 months. Later that practice was changed, and now male missionaries serve 24 months again. Those are practices. Some of them are done by revelation, some aren't, but they initiate somewhere by someone. Anyway, so I don't think the fact that it's not a revelation and wasn't revealed or might not even be scripturally based is, in my opinion, that big a deal on the issue, because it is a practice. Anyway, Dr. Nibley said that in 73 that he saw the practice, the restrictive practices, is providing the members with, quote, the best possible test for their faith, their hope, and above all, their charity, unquote. He stated the test as being one which every Latter-day Saint, every individual Latter-day Saint had to resolve for himself and herself. And then he said this, again, I'm quoting Dr. Nibley. Our scriptures tell us that all little children are pure and innocent by nature, and as such saved in the celestial kingdom of God. Now the vast majority of blacks, he used Negroes then, but he said the vast majority of Negroes who have lived on earth have died as little children. The celestial kingdom will be full of them, while there may be few present-day priesthood holders among them. Has this been duly noticed? The hardest thing in the world for men to learn is, quote, this one lesson, that the rights of the priesthood are inseparably connected with the powers of heaven. These rights are God's alone to give and take away, and no one will dispute his right to do as he pleases with that which is his own. So now the whole issue boils down to asking whether it was really God and not man who ordered these things. Members and non-members alike, who up until now have laughed at the thought of asking such a question, are suddenly exercised by it. And so it gives me great pleasure to be in a position to answer the question with an unequivocal affirmative. It is indeed the Lord's doing. How do I know? By personal revelation, which I am in no position to bestow upon others. This goes only for myself. Now, how do I stand up here today and say that I know it was the Lord's doing that led to this restriction? In these latter days, that was done away with in 1978, it's by personal revelation. And I can't tell you what to think on this. That's up to your matter of faith. That's a matter of faith for you. But I know for myself, because I've studied it out, and more importantly, I've prayed and asked the Heavenly Father about it, that, you know, this is His priesthood, seen things, and what impact it had on me. So that's what my book is about. Anyway, when you look at the parable of the laborers, you see a couple distinct things. One, that there are laborers called at different times, okay? In the first hour, laborers were those that the Lord went out, the Lord of the vineyard, representing the Lord, went out and chose who to call as first hour laborers. He personally picked those people out. Then you come to the third, sixth, and ninth hour laborers, and they responded to a general call, okay? And then you come to the 11th hour laborers. And in the 11th hour laborers, the Lord, again, personally had a discussion with these. And you find out that these laborers had been out there the whole day, wanting to work in the field, in the vineyard. But for some reason, they weren't permitted. And the Lord asked them about it and said, you know, why stand ye here all the day? And the laborer said, because no man has called us. And then the Lord said, well, go into the vineyard, and he sent them in the vineyard. And then we know about the payment, that the Lord called those laborers first, the 11th hour laborers, gave them a penny. The first hour laborers got upset about it. And the Lord made it very clear to them when he said, you know, hey, because they supposed they should receive more. And the Lord said, basically, look, you know, is thy eye evil because I'm good? I can do what I want with mine. And he said, everyone gets a penny. And that parable teaches us a great lesson, because what it tells us is it really doesn't matter when you're called and under what circumstances you're called, and whether you come from Joseph Smith line, or whether you were baptized yesterday, that if you do your part in the vineyard, the Lord's going to pay you the same. The other one, and I would ask you to read that. In fact, Bruce R. McConkie referred to that parable and called the blacks that were received the priesthood the 11th hour laborers. The second one is the story of the blind beggar. And you guys know that one. The man that was born blind. And as Christ and his apostles came by, the question was posed to Christ, you know, why is this man born blind? Who did sin, he or his parents, that he was born blind? And the Lord's response was neither. He was born blind so that the works of God could be made manifest in him, and he went on to heal him. Okay, I think that teaches us a great lesson, because it kind of goes to the two main arguments or positions of why were they denied the priesthood. The first is that, you know, they did something on their own, or they were less valiant in heaven. The second one was they were of bad lineage, which meant that they were the seed of Cain. If you follow that story out to conclusion, you find that, you know, this person was disadvantaged, born blind, not because of anything he had done or because he had bad parents, but because so that he can be an instrument in the hands of the Lord. And I think that's the situation for African Americans. I think African Americans chose, in fact, I've had several personal experiences that led me to believe this, and I'm going to close here, but I think African Americans chose to come to this earth under these conditions. I think many of them, like Jane Manning James and Elijah Abel, understood exactly what they were doing when they came down here, and that, you know, by choosing to be part of the restricted class, they were actually helping to lead the way to the understanding that led to the lifting of the restriction. You know, when you think about it, there couldn't be a lifting of the restriction if there wasn't a restriction in the first place. Just like there wouldn't have been no atonement if there hadn't been a fall. I believe that this 1978 revelation was one of the greatest events in the history of mankind. I think it shows the charitable and merciful relationship that we have with our Heavenly Father. I don't think it's about blacks. I think it's about mankind in general. I think it opened up the door for the growth of the church, which was really the main issue that led President Kimball to approach the Lord, that led to the 78 revelation. And I think we're being very short-sighted when we talk about the priesthood being being granted to all worthy male, just in terms of African Americans. And I think if we do a little bit more research and look on a more global scale, that we'll see that Heavenly Father used this lifting of the restriction as a way to increase the opportunity for all His children around the world to come to join His church. Lastly, let me just say that I'm married to a Haitian, and I served in the military in different parts of the world. And this priesthood issue among blacks, not African American, but among blacks, seems to be only a U.S. American thing. Okay, people, blacks in the Caribbean, blacks in Africa, really don't seem to have that big of a problem with it. It's just that, and it seems to be because of the historical relationship between the United States and African Americans that leads to part of the problem. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to turn the time over now for questions and answers, Q&A. And if you have a question to ask, why don't you come up to the mic, because they are recording this. And sort of limit your questions so we can have an array of responses. Thank you.
I have a question for the panelists, including Darren. This has to do with the ethical responsibility of we present-day Mormons in the face of continuing folklore about blacks. And let me just give one example that contradicts a little bit what Alma said about Bruce Herman Conkey. In the 1979 edition of Mormon Doctrine, which is published today, it's the same one that's in the store today, it says, among other things, non-whites are spiritually inferior to whites, dark skin is a curse from God, racial segregation is a divine principle, and all blacks are from the seed of Ham or Cain. So you can think of that as one example, but just more broadly, there's continuing negative folklore. What ethical responsibility do current Mormons have with regards to that?
I guess it occurs to me that this issue has come up in the Gospel Principles class that I teach two or three times. It's obviously not in the manual. And the response I always give people is that it's my own belief from my own study that there wasn't a doctrinal scriptural basis for the doctrine. It was my own belief as a historian that it was one of those pieces of cultural baggage that we picked up. I have my own theories about when it took place. And that it's something that should have been changed before it was, but I am uncomfortable seizing it as an issue that causes people problems. I mean, I just think the bigger picture ought to be trying to help people be involved in the gospel and the ward as much as possible. So I guess I would try to limit my discussions of it in that context. I mean, I've read some of that stuff in McConkie too, and I wish the church would take that book out of publication. I think it's problematic in a lot of areas.
I think it's a sticky issue to say what is our ethical responsibility and how do we handle that, in that I don't think that the church is ever going to make a public apology or make a public definition of how we should interpret these scriptures. They don't do that on any other object. And we have to be careful that we're not out trying to steady the ark as well. I think that that the best that we can do is educate people, challenge people to think about it. I've been in the Gospel Essentials class when it's come up, and someone has given what I think to be an absolutely incorrect answer, and my question is, where do you get that? And when they think about it, they invariably say, well, I don't know, I'll have to get back to you on that. And I think if we can continue to encourage people to think about it and look at the scriptures, I think we've fulfilled our ethical responsibilities without trying to direct the church or make sure that we are trying to dictate to the leaders of the church how it's supposed to work.
I don't know if we have an ethical responsibility to tell people how to think. I usually, you know, like Brother Allred, I might raise the issue as to where this information come from. I've been in situations where people brought it up in gospel doctrine class and others, and I might say, well, I don't, where does that come from? Help me find that in the scriptures or something, and they can't. In personal conversations, I ask people to, you know, study it out, and I refer on the section, I think it's 9, isn't it? Study it out and ask if it's true, and come up with their own response. And that's what I really believe is the answer. It's worked for me, and I think the Lord will let you know. And if He doesn't give you an answer, He'll at least give you a piece about it. And I've seen that with so many African American Latter-day Saints that I think that's very helpful, to just have a piece about it and to go on about your business, you know, building the kingdom and helping others.
I think one way I've come to peace with that is a comment that I heard from Marguerite Dreesen, who's a BYU professor of law. And she was discussing the issue and saying that, she was citing the fervor of the blacks in Ghana and in various other pockets, where they have been very ready to receive the gospel for a long time and have been waiting for the go-ahead on the leadership. And her contention, which I adopt, is that it wasn't waiting, that the breaking of the ban wasn't waiting for the blacks to be ready. It was waiting for the whites to be ready to accept it. And I think that includes our leaders, that however devoted they are to the gospel, they still have a cultural background that keeps them from seeing without some coloration. Anyway, Brother Smith, is it? You stated that you were in a different position from Brother Hamilton. I'd enjoy hearing from you what your position is.
Well, I'm just not as sure about the faith-based answers to these issues, particularly when I look at the endemic racist practices that were widespread in the United States for so long. And I think that, I don't think that, and even, unfortunately, even in religions, even religious-based organizations, I think that there's something much greater than simply saying that, you know, the Lord wasn't ready. I mean, I've been there. I mean, I've been where Brother Hamilton is. I mean, I've gone through that fiery furnace as well. And I've just gone a different direction with that. I think my studies in studying race institutionally, studying it, how it operates behaviorally, attitudes and beliefs and so on, has led me to believe that this is more about attitudes and beliefs and institutional practices than it is about God or invoking God as the source or the source of this particular issue or scapegoating God for what I believe was white racism at the time. I believe very fervently that I think white folks deliberately, if you will, established this particular practice for whatever reason. I think that I guess if you want to point back to who initiated it, who originated it, the research seems to indicate that Brigham Young did in 1842. So the question that I asked, and as I read Brigham Young's biographies and look at the kind of works that he was involved in, and I look at the era that Brigham Young grew up in, around the 1830s, clear up into the 1890s. There was an awful lot of theoretical notions about racial differences flourishing in the United States. Two major theoretical frameworks, one being monogenesis, the belief in Adam and Eve, that Adam and Eve peopled the earth, the other belief in this notion of polygenesis, that there were multiple Adams. And seeing how this debate played out and essentially was settled in effect by Darwin's theories of evolution, if you look at the race-based, the sort of science of it all, and seeing how religion initially was used as sort of the way to talk about racial differences, and to see how members of the church were also exposed to various magazines that were published, primarily Atlantic Monthly being one of them, Scientific Northern Review being another, and how these sorts of ideologies about racial difference were taken up and published, republished, and reprinted in early church publications like the Millennial Star, Times and Season, and others, and how members of the church had access to the very same corrosive racial understandings leads me to believe, in my own study, in my own research, and I've also came to a conclusion of this. I've also taken these matters to the Lord, right? So I can say that in a Sunstone conference, right? And feel equally as compelled and equally as moved as my colleague Keith does about these issues. I'm not willing to let white people off the hook so easy, and I'm not so willing to absolve them of their responsibility for ending it. I think that blacks have done about as much as they can do, and progressive whites who are members of the church have done about as much as they can do to end the folklore once and for all. I don't want to have to be in a position where I have to defend my religion to other people. I don't want to have to be in that position. Whites are not in that position. They might take it upon themselves to be in that position, but in terms of how my body is politicized, I'll mention that again, I always have to defend my position as a member of the church. And I would like very much to see more people join the church, okay? And in respect to Africa and the Caribbean islands and the other continents that have melanated peoples, they have an entirely different social history with white supremacy. White supremacy in the context of the United States was predicated primarily on slavery. Later, racial ideologies evolved from that. Whereas in continents such as the Caribbean islands, for instance, or Africa or other countries, these individuals had to deal with whites in terms of colonization. So in large part, they were able to maintain a large portion of their culture as opposed to American blacks who had to give up a lot in order to acquiesce to what whites wanted them to do, primarily was gang labor. So I think that white folks need to look at themselves in terms of this issue and be courageous enough to call their fellow brothers and sisters out in the event that they're making inappropriate statements about blacks or using scriptural references. Because what I'm hearing about this issue of blacks in the priesthood is no different than what Winthrop Jordan was talking about in the 1500s. The same sort, he being a historian, the same sort of racial ideology that was so prevalent then is still prevalent now. So I've gone beyond the faith-based explanations for why this issue was and wasn't conducive for Mormonism. I'm not suggesting that my brother Hamilton is wrong. I'm just suggesting that I've moved beyond that particular analysis into something a little bit more acceptable for my own self, particularly as I look at other institutional practices where whites have dominated and have maintained similar policies or created similar policies whereby blacks and other groups were left out and left behind. So I think that this is, to me, this would be another example of that, just in a much more personal way, because it's a faith-based issue. We're talking about people's belief systems. Right? So. Yeah, I indicated that. I just. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I don't have a problem with getting rid of the folklore. I think it's damaging. What I do have a problem is, and what Darren can't answer is, you know, he wants to take God out of it, and I can't. And I'll tell you why. You know, I know the history of being of going way back. I know all of that. In fact, I know more about it than Darren, even though he thinks he knows more about it than me. But the bottom line is this. We're not talking about a social issue in denying blacks to vote, the right to vote or the right to be counted as one human being. We're talking about the priesthood of God, and we're talking about a restriction that not only had validity here on the earth, but it went beyond the veil. And I want you to think about that. Brother Kimball had the priesthood in 1974. He couldn't have gone in the temple and do the work for my grandfather. Okay, now think about that. Okay, so all this history stuff, and I want you to think about this, and if you can come up with an answer, tell me. Okay, why Joseph Smith lost 116 pages of the manuscript. You remember this? Okay, and the Lord already had a backup plan in place, didn't he? Right? You remember? You know what I'm talking about? And he chastised Joseph, didn't he? And he was about to take his power away. Now, you're going to tell me that God's going to sit up there and let Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or somebody unilaterally decide that based on reading times and seasons or whatever they read, that we're going to take the priest, I gave Joseph the priesthood, and he gave it to all mankind. And we're going to let Brigham Young take the priesthood away from these people, not let them have the blessings of the eternity that was the whole reason I sent them down here to do. And he's just going to sit back and be asleep on a watch. I think it's about what your belief in God is about and not what you think about the leaders of the church and what they might have read or what they might have said. And I don't believe God's that kind of God. I don't believe he would have sat there and let this happen and let some white men, angry white men, take away the opportunity for my grandfather and my great-grandfather to have the gospel in its fullness until 1978. I think there was a bigger purpose. I think it was part of an eternal plan. And not only that, I think I'm a much better person because I had to go through what I went through, and I value the priesthood more because I've gone through what I went through. Thanks.
I appreciate this panel, and I want you to know I do, and I really regret having missed Darren's previous session, but I couldn't go because I was presenting at the same time as Darren. This is a topic that's of great concern to me and has always been distressing, and I'm somewhat distressed by this session. It's important to me. I have taught African American literature. I have a chapter in my book, Faithful Transgressions in the American West, on a black Mormon woman's autobiography, Black Mormon Tells Her Story. She was, I assume you know about that autobiography. I also am a big sister to a little sister who's black, and I have many black people in my life who have taught me lots just experientially. And I think one of the reasons that I'm no longer active in the church is over some of these issues and over my distress going to the temple and not seeing people of color. My distress here seeing only these two panelists as people of color here in the audience. And I know that there are other people, you know, I was having a hard time deciding which session to go to at this particular time. But there aren't any people of color at Sunstone as far as I can see visually. And that's just a visual look. I believe that there's a racist practice that I believe this was a racist practice. And I believe that people continue to, my little sister, who is in an evangelical church, sees me as in the white church. And I go with her to her black church. And she sees the world in black and white ways that I continue to work with her on. But she perceives the Mormon church to be white. And there's a reason for that. And what I heard you say, well, you wouldn't find this in the manuals of the church. That's what I would like to see the church do more of, is to speak more honestly. I think that's our ethical responsibility, to start to speak in ways that, Darren, I think that you just did here when you were saying this is... But I don't know that we have the capability of it. And so I guess in one way, that's a comment. I'm tired of tiptoeing around, and it feels like we're still tiptoeing around it and not talking about why do we not see people of color in a temple film. I don't understand that, except I think I understand it. And I do think there's a difference, too, between what's happening in America and other places because of the history of America and white and black relations. So I would be in the church still, too, in many ways, if I was hearing those kinds of frank conversations about how naive white folks are about people in different cultures because they have not as much contact. And I think that Georgia is, it sounds like there are wonderful inroads there, but in many places in the United States, most of the congregations are white, and they feel people of color who would come to those congregations feel much like I do when I go to evangelicals with my friends, very, you know, you don't feel necessarily that you belong, especially initially in the group. That doesn't mean that you couldn't later. I think I need to stop. And yes. My response to that would be, I don't think you should care, in one sense, that it shouldn't matter, and that But then in another way, I think it should matter, because I think it's important and helpful for people to see people who are like them in particular places. It helps, it makes you feel like you have a sense of belonging, in an invitation to be there. If I see, for example, I mean, I could speak about this in terms of being a woman and seeing a group of people that they're mainly men. I know that I'm not, you know, if you look historically at the Senate or the House of Representatives, and what you see is mostly men there, then you see it as this is a, you know, you perceive it either consciously or unconsciously as a place where you don't necessarily belong, or where you aren't necessarily going to be invited to. Yes.
I don't have a problem. You know, I like to hear better music in sacrament music.
Mm-hmm.
I like to see more relaxed. I mean, what I'm talking about, why...
But why... So my answer to that question is, why should I care, is that I think if you could see more blacks, there would be more blacks. And so we have to ask ourselves, why are there not more blacks or people of color in particular places? I mean, I think that that's ultimately the question to get at. It's not who we see or not, et cetera, but why are people of color not drawn to particular religions, and why are they drawn to others? Why are whites drawn to particular religions or not? I mean, much of that is cultural in many ways.
Right. You ask the black kids we're talking about. Tell myself we joined the church because of the doctrine. And we recognize that the priesthood thing is not a doctrine.
But you don't necessarily, as I hear you say, recognize it as a racist issue, and I think it is. And I think that that's at the root of
I just want to say one thing. In response to Keith's just brief statement when he said we need to put God in it, My assumption is God was never in it to begin with. If God were in it, we wouldn't be having this issue in terms of a much more deeper dialogue or dialogical process. So that's my response to that. And contrary to what he might think, I know more than him.
I sympathize somewhat with Keith's expression that you'd just like to be regarded as a saint. Doesn't make any difference whether you're black, white, purple, green, what have you. I'm single, and I sometimes feel that all this concerted program for singles, that why can't I just be regarded as a brother in the gospel? Nevertheless, my concern is that sometimes inadvertent slights, maybe not mean-spirited, but inadvertent things can occur. And I would like to know from Darren and Keith what sorts of things you think that maybe we white folk ought to be a little more conscious of.
I don't take it personal what white people say to me in terms of the whatever slights that they make. And contrary to my strident bravado about whiteness and white supremacy, I love everybody. I'm not racist in that sense or anyone else. I think people would tend to construct me as an angry black man because I speak ill of the status quo. And that's not the point at all. If I were that way, I wouldn't be going to church every Sunday. So I think that I resonate with my fellow brothers and sisters, but I think that there's a disingenuousness there about this discussion about race. I think there's a tendency, even in the discussion I'm hearing here, to demystify it or mystify it in terms of making it colorblind. And the problem is we're not colorblind. We ought not pretend to be colorblind. We're extraordinarily color conscious. And the moment we begin to engage that process, we might have some beautiful things emerge that will go beyond this idea of pretending that we're all brothers and sisters, which I believe that we are. But I also believe that there's a performance element there to it as well. We're brothers and sisters as long as we don't call each other niggas, right? As long as we don't call each other homophobia, as long as we don't transgress whatever boundaries of normality that have been established by institutional practices, whether it be in religions or whether it be in society in general. We're all just well and good as long as we don't transgress. The moment we do that, we've got problems. I've heard that time and time again by these fundamentalist folks who've been here today, who've talked a lot about their personal experiences being fundamentalists. So I don't get mad or upset at white folks. I use it as an opportunity to teach. To teach them how to be more critical. I think that what I do agree with Keith, and Keith may not articulate it this way, but what I do believe is that the part of this process that folks of color have had to endure, I believe fervently, is to help whites become more human. That's an interesting idea. Okay, I can flush that out more in a paper or something too. And the reason why I'm saying that. It's because whites don't have the same luxury, if you want to call it a luxury, okay, or if you want to call it a problem or a concern, of living in two worlds, okay, one black, one white. Now, Keith can pretend that he doesn't live that way, but I'm suggesting that that's what blacks have to do every single day, or people of color in general, or women have to live in a masculine world and accommodate men in very specific ways. And we do it all the time. And I'm suggesting that it has a cost on folks of color. One of the things I want to indicate, too, that I said earlier in a presentation that I gave is that the LDS Church, in context of the United States, tends to be more successful amongst middle-class blacks, middle-class and upper-middle-class blacks, right, as opposed to working-class blacks. Now, I'm not suggesting that they don't join the church as much as I'm saying that I think that those who tend to find Mormonism more appealing as African-Americans are middle-class blacks. The simple reason is they're used to being around white people. They're used to being more integrated settings than blacks who survive and exist in predominantly segregated communities. So I think that for me to traverse Mormonism as a middle-class, educated black person, right, I can sort of identify with people across class lines, right, and I can speak to people in a way that they can sort of understand where I'm coming from. Right, so I can perform middle class, if you will. Whereas I think that my middle class or my working class black counterparts may not be as adept at that, and maybe struggle more. So than maybe someone like me or someone like Keith. I don't put words in Keith's mouth, but I would definitely argue that Keith is middle class. But having said that, that's where we need to work at. It's not so much with folks like me, okay, per se, but it's trying to find ways to bring in working class blacks who could tremendously benefit from being members of the church, I believe, in my opinion. But I think that there's got to be some significant cultural shifts. So I'll leave it at that.
Did you want me to respond?
Yes. I'll make it very quickly. I'll make it simple. I disagree with Darren on the fundamental issue of why we're here. I believe I chose to be a black person and come to earth at this time, that God didn't force me into my skin, that it was a choice, that in the premortal life it was all about, the war in heaven was all about choice, and that I chose to do that. And that I'm going through what I'm going through, not to make you better people, but to make me more godlike. See? The gospel, we're talking about the gospel here. We're not talking about some social experiment. We're talking about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the gospel is not, the truthfulness of the gospel is not conditioned on how the mortals treat one another. Okay? And that's what I think people are missing. They want to define the truthfulness of the gospel and the legitimacy of the church as the kingdom of God here on earth based on the way I treat you and the way you treat me. That'll never be an indication of how true the gospel is. And I've found that African-American Latter-day Saints, like Jane Manning Jane, like Elijah Abel. Now, if Elijah Abel was here, he could tell you what it felt like to have the priesthood, be in the quorum of the 70, and then be told not to use his priesthood anymore. And then he can explain to you why he stayed faithful and died coming home from a mission to go and preach that same truth to others. See, that to me tells me more than anything else that's been said about this issue. The life of Jane Manning James tells me more about the spiritual and faith-based foundation of this issue than anything else. And I can't take God out of it. We're talking about the priesthood of God, and I can't take God out of it. Now, to answer your specific question, you know, when I joined a church, I made a covenant to do certain things, and God made a covenant to do things toward me. And that covenant didn't say that white people were going to treat me nice in the church. And it didn't say I was going to be the happiest guy in the church. Okay? And I don't think that's part of my deal with God. Okay? And so, you know, I expect to be treated like a black person in this church, just like I expect to be treated like a black person in America, and I expect to be treated like a black person in Utah. And what happens here and the way people treat me when they see me as a black person and not as Keith Hamilton doesn't surprise me at all.